All right, good morning, everybody. It is Thursday, May 5th, 11:13 a.m. right now. So this is our second to last week, next week being our last week of lecture. And I'm sitting here, I've been sitting here for a while now, thinking about kind of where I wanted to go, how much I want to do. We've really just finished up SN1, SN2, E1, E2. And so, you know, we did a whole lot of examples on Monday on the lecture that I posted. Was it Monday? On Tuesday, the lecture that I posted for Tuesday. And I really don't have, I mean, I can make more examples. We could constantly go on and keep picking up more examples, but I really don't have a whole lot. And so basically, just sort of to close it up here and to think about what's going on, we have a chemical reaction that can go a number of different directions. We could go SN2. We could go E2. We could go SN1. We could go E1. And really, what determines which direction it goes is a whole bunch of different factors that change constantly, depending upon what's actually going on in the problem. We've seen that. As I've gone through these examples, we've seen that there's a lot of different ideas there. But some of the really core ideas is that if this is a primary substrate, it's going SN2 almost exclusively, unless we use something like a bulky base, which can override it. If we're looking at E2s, this generally is where we see something like a bulky base come into play that can generally drive something towards E2. SN1, these are sulfolysis. This is no nucleophile. And so we see the sulfolysis reactions come into play. And then when we go E1, this is really where we see carbocations in the presence of an anion. So we'll say anionic base. Any sort of anionic base will take and push the carbocations. So down here in SN1 and C1, we're looking at carbocations, and we have to really closely watch for any shifts that are possible, alkyl shifts, hydride shifts. Those things are happening down here for the SN1 and E1. For SN2 and E2, we're really watching more stereochemistry. And then we have all those other concepts and things that could be going on. But really, this is sort of what highlights when things take priority. A bulky base takes priority over almost anything else and generally shifts a reaction towards E2. Primary substrate almost always goes towards SN2. Tertiary substrates can go SN1, they can go E1, they can go E2. So tertiary substrates have, they tend to go those directions. And in fact, what we can do is we can add sort of a secondary sort of idea here that tertiary substrate is important in many regards for these guys, because you're looking at either carbocation formation or the formation of a highly substituted double bond. And so tertiary goes that way. Now, where does secondary go? Secondary can go any place. Secondary can go SN2, it can go E2, it can go SN1, it can go E1. So secondaries are really the hard one, because secondary can go any of the four. It can go any direction. So while tertiaries make it a little bit complicated in that I've got three that I've got to sort out. Primaries are the easiest, secondaries are the hardest, but then I'm really keying in to some of those other ideas. I'm keying into that bulky base idea that really pushes me E2. I'm keying into this carbocation with any anionic base goes E1. No nucleophile tends to go SN1. And then that primary substrate, SN2. That can go a long way to deciding what direction a reaction is going. Now that's leaving out solvent, that's leaving out temperature, that's leaving out a lot of other things. But those are some of the quick, easy decisions that when I look at a reaction, that I'm looking for those key things to try to figure out what those key things are. Bulky base, by the way, when we talk about a bulky base, there are really only two, and that is the potassium tert-butoxide. When I say only two, I mean only two that we, within the context of this course, really deal with. That's potassium tert-butoxide, and the other one is LDA, lithium diisopropyl amide. And we generally write it as LDA, but LDA is lithium, it's the cation, and then there is a nitrogen anion that has diisopropyl groups on it. That is lithium diisopropyl amide. And those are the two bulky bases that we come into contact with the most. That's not to say that we couldn't create other bulky bases or other bases that would have a lot of steric bulk to them. We certainly do see those, and they are used throughout the literature. But these are the two that we come into contact with the most. And in terms of any anionic base, examples might be things like acetate. Sodium acetate. So that could be written NaOAC, could be a weak base in that regard. That could be things like sodium carbonate, Na2CO3 would be a weak anionic base. So any of these weak bases can push a reaction from an SN1 into an E1 when we see those types of things that are sitting in there. And in terms of solvolysis, when we're looking at solvents for solvolysis, the solvents that we typically see for these types of reactions are alcohol type solvents. We might see methanol, ethanol, might see isopropanol, or tertiary butanol. There tend to be alcohols, but we also tend to see sometimes acetic acid or carboxylic acid type solvents come into play in that. These are solvents that can replace and substitute onto a carbocation to produce ethers and to produce esters. And so those are the types of solvents that we see in those SN1 reactions. So this is just the last like closeout. Let's call it SN1, SN2, E1, E2 closeout. And just trying to hit home some of those basic ideas on what it is that I'm looking for in terms of how to decide where a reaction is going and some quick and easy ways to look at that. Looking to see if I have any other things that I want to go over. And without your questions, it's really hard when you're not here to go question-wise. So I think that's where I want to close it. And I think that moves us into chapter 8, and we can do a little bit within chapter 8. So I'm going to start a whole new page here. Chapter 8, let's talk about this for a minute. Chapter 8 is about alkenes and the reactions associated with alkenes. Normally what we do is a progression where we go through and we look at, number one, the nomenclature. Number two, we would talk about stability of alkenes and double bonds. And then number three, we start getting into the reactions that are the addition reactions to alkenes. We want to look at both the formation of alkenes and reactions of alkenes. So we do both within this chapter. So there's quite a bit that goes into this chapter as we start to look at it. And it's a fairly large chapter with a lot of different reactions, all of them very, very similar in terms of the mechanism and the way that these reactions go forward. So let's maybe start there. Let's look at nomenclature, which we've already done a little bit. We'll formalize it some more. Nomenclature. Let's look at stability, because that plays into things a little bit. We want to do reactivity. And we want to do formation. So those are all the things that we kind of want to hit within this. And let's go ahead and pick it up with nomenclature. When we do the nomenclature of an alkene, remember that what we're looking at is the difference between a double bond, which are on opposite sides, or the groups that are the primary groups are on opposite sides versus the groups on the same side. I'm going to have language problems here. These we have always referred to simplistically as trans. And these, when they're on the same side, as cis. We did introduce the idea that cis and trans are very simplistic, and that what we can also do is refer to these as E and Z in stereochemistry designation. E meaning entgegen. So this is, let's see if I spell it right, entgegen, G-E-G-E-N. And that means opposite in German. And Z is for Zeusonen. And I apologize for my pronunciation if anybody is fluent in German. I am not. I'll do the best that I can. And that is together. Which is where the idea comes from on the same side. So when we have an alkene and we go through and we designate the alkene, we can use cis and trans for very simplistic ones, but as it gets more complicated, we use E or Z. We've done this before, I think. We've talked about it a bit, but if I have a double bond that has a number of different functional groups or components attached, let's do this. Let's leave a hydrogen here. And I want to put a chlorine in this molecule as well. When I go through and number the molecule, I do the numbering in the same way that I normally would. In other words, I want to find the longest carbon chain. That longest carbon chain must include the double bond, if the double bond is the primary functional group. There's a hierarchy of functional groups, and we're actually going through this as a functional group approach. Each of the functional groups that we do in turn takes precedent over the last functional group. So we're going to do alkynes after we do alkenes. Alkynes have a higher priority than alkenes. If there's an alkyne in the molecule, then the alkyne takes the priority, and the longest chain must include the alkyne. So longest carbon chain to include alkene. So we can go through and we can number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That would appear to be the longest carbon chain. But that carbon chain could be numbered the opposite direction. I could start off with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. We want the numbering system that has the lowest number for the alkene. So no longer at the first point of difference. Now we change, and we want a numbering system where the alkene gets the lowest possible number. So the correct system then is going to be the red system, where the alkene starts at 2. So that is going to be my numbering system. Then what I need to do is, after I decide on what my numbering system is, I need to assign priorities. And we use the Kahn-Ingold-Prelog rules. So these are the Kahn-Ingold-Prelog rules to assign priorities. The same rules that we use when we do stereochemical designations for R or S. We apply those same rules to figure out priorities of the different groups and then decide what the substitution pattern is on the double bond. So here what I do is I always redraw the molecule. And I compare one side of the molecule, and then I'll compare the other side. So what I need to do, and I'll draw this in. Oh, this was going to be a hydrogen. Maybe what I'll do is I'll draw this in. And what I would like to do is I would like to compare these two sides. So I'm going to focus over here and over here on this side of the molecule first. Basically, what I'm doing is I'm cutting the molecule in half this way. And I'm comparing the right side and the left side of the double bond to see which group has priority on the left side and on the right side. So we come out to this point and we say, what's attached here? This is a carbon, and attached to that carbon is a chlorine and two hydrogens. That's what's attached at that point. And then I come over here and this is a carbon, and that carbon is attached to two carbons and a hydrogen. So which one takes priority? It's the chlorine. The chlorine has the highest atomic number and takes priority because of its highest atomic number. So what that does is that sets out that this group with the chlorine on it, despite it being the smaller carbon chain, it has the higher atomic mass at first point of difference, and it takes priority. Then we do the same thing on the other side. So we do the right side and we do the left side. Drawing it multiple times can be helpful in terms of figuring out what's going on. Now, this is not a complicated one, because now as I look at the left-hand side and I look at what's going on here, I've really only got hydrogen versus methyl. And so same thing, I would be comparing the carbon and the hydrogen. And what takes priority there is going to be the carbon. The carbon has the higher atomic number. I don't need to look at what's attached to the carbon, because the other one is a hydrogen, and I'm comparing directly the atoms that I first approach. And if it were a carbon that were on this bottom side, if it were a carbon down here, then yes, I would have to compare what's attached to it, but I don't need to do that right now. And then after going through and doing that, now I can take these guys and I can look at the overall molecule and I can decide whether the molecule is an E or a Z. So we redraw the molecule again. And now what I'll do is I'll highlight out my different groups. So priority was on the chlorine. Priority is there. And basically what I'm doing now is I'm looking at the molecule as if I'm looking down the bond, and I'm saying, are these two groups that have highest priority, are they on the same side of the molecule, or are they on opposite sides of the molecule? And these are on the same side. So the same side, as we go back up here and look at that, that zeosamine, that's together. So this is a Z double bond. So we have figured out the chemistry, the stereochemistry of the double bond. Now the next thing that we need to do is we need to look at the substituents. So we need to four identify substituents. And then number five, we need to construct the name. So very similar to what we were doing before, let me go ahead and take and redraw it one more time. I think this will be the last time. I think we were able to get the molecule name from this. Actually, I'm going to delete that hydrogen because it just kind of sits in my way there in terms of what I need to do. So the longest carbon chain goes this way. I have substituents which are sitting here. So this is a substituent. This methyl is a substituent. We have already identified that this is a Z double bond, that they're on the same side, the groups. And we already have our numbering system, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So identifying my substituents on carbon number 3, I have a chloromethyl. So how do I do this? This is a complex substituent. This is going to be a 1-chloromethyl. On number 4, I have a methyl. And that Z double bond, the alkene, on number 2 is the start of the alkene. And that stereochemistry Z, this is a 2Z, although the 2 is redundant because there's only one double bond. So if there's only one double bond, then I don't need to indicate the locator number. But then I go through and, this is based on a hexane. But we're going to drop this A-N-E ending. And we're going to use the E-N-E ending. Alphabetization goes when it's a complex side chain by the first letter. Otherwise, we go, in both of these cases, we're going to alphabetize on C, we're going to alphabetize on M. In complex side chains, we always alphabetize on the first letter regardless. When we're alphabetizing and it's not complex, we don't alphabetize on di or tri or tetra. We avoid those and we move on to the substituent name and we alphabetize on the substituent name. So this is going to be chloro before methyl. And then putting the whole thing together, it is a 2Z. I said the 2 could be left out, it's redundant. We start off with the 3-chloro. Methyl. Then we go to the 4-methyl. Then we go to the hex. And then we would put in the locator number for the alkene that we're doing, and then the E-N-E ending, hex-2-ene. So that's the overall name. So we always have stereochemistry in the front. Then we pick up and we do substituents. Then we have the chain length. And then we have functional group. That's how that all pans out in terms of drawing it. If we're working backwards and we're working from the name to draw the molecule, then I just do it in reverse. Usually what I do is I start off with the parent chain, number it, throw in my substituents, and then I look to see is it E or Z, and then I make sure that I draw either the E or the Z, resolving it after I've drawn much of the compound. So for instance, if I were to take this name and I were to work backwards from this name, how would I go about and do it? I would look at it and I would say, first off, this is a hex-2-ene. So to start, I would draw 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I would go ahead and add my numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's a 2-een. So I would go ahead and I would draw in the 2-een. Then I would draw 4-methyl. Then I would draw the 3-chloromethyl. And then I would check for my E or Z. So then I could go in and I could say, all right, what did I draw? Now I just check. So I don't try to anticipate, but I now go and check and say, all right, chlorine on one side, methyl, those have the highest priorities. They are on the same side. That is indeed a Z zeusamen together. And that would be how I would go about and draw that. And you notice that I've drawn it in a different orientation than what it was drawn up there. But that's how I would go about and do it, is I would just make my chain. I always started off as a zigzag chain in standard format. I number just left to right. You can number right to left, it makes no difference. You're gonna come out with the same thing. Drop in your substituents on your numbers and then check for E or Z for your double bond. And you can run it in reverse. So that's how we go through and do that. All right. So that's the nomenclature. Nomenclature is not hard. You're always responsible for nomenclature. I don't do a lot of examples with nomenclature. It's in the book. It's very standard. And I always expect you guys to read the book and to understand nomenclature. And it shows up on every test in terms of probably the first question on every test that we do. All right. We have done this before when we look at stabilities of double bonds. Let's pick it up and just reinforce it. When we look at stability of alkenes, what we find is that the more substituted an alkene, oh, I should run this from the bottom too. The more substituted an alkene, the more stable it is. And so as we go through and look at it, the most stable alkene that we can have are the tetrasubstituted alkenes. After tetrasubstituted, it's tri. And then we have a series of disubstituted, most stable being the trans, then the cis, then the geminal, monosubstituted, and then unsubstituted. So these are in order of increasing stability. Just to show that, if we take a couple of isomers, I can look at isomers of, what is this? 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a butene. And so I'm looking at 3-methylbutene. I can look at 2-methylbutene. Put that there. Let's see. This would be the 2-methyl. Let's slide all these over a little bit. And then let's look at this is a 1. This is what I need to do. There we go. So this is a 2-methylbutene. And then here what I have is a 2-methyl. No dash between here. 2-methyl-but. I'm trying to do a 2-ene-but. 2-ene in the way that changes. So these are all isomers of one another. And stability wise, what we find is that the delta H of formation for these is minus 30.3. I'm going to guess that these are in kilojoules per mole because I don't have the units on there. I wish I did. This is minus 28.5. And then finally, minus 26.9. And that is what that is showing me is that is showing me, let's see, how can I make this hit home? This is showing me that when I combust these, how much energy comes out is one way to do it, or I could hydrogenate them, taking them down to the saturated component. What we find is that less energy is coming out of this molecule, which means that it is closer to, or it is more stable. It is not as high in energy. There's less potential energy that's in the system because less energy is coming out of this. Or I could look at it in terms of the delta H formations that relative, if I think about this and I'm forming these from carbon and hydrogen, and this is a formation component, and I'm looking at just carbon and hydrogen, and I'm looking at the formation of these, that this guy is minus 26.9 kilojoules per mole. This one is minus 28. This one is minus 30. And that this is less energy. It is less potential energy, essentially, that is stored in the molecule. And therefore, this molecule is much more stable than the other ones. Now, when we go through and we look at that, why is that the case? We're looking at monosubstituted. We're looking at disubstituted. We're looking at trisubstituted. And so we can see the relative stability of each one of these molecules in terms of the double bond that is being formed there. All right. So we've done that before. We've talked about that stability before. That's important when we start to look at the double bonds and formation of double bonds. It's also important sometimes in terms of the reactivity of a double bond and which double bond is more reactive than another double bond. Okay, let's take a look at a reaction called hydration. When we look at the hydration of an alkene, this is where we take an alkene and add water to it. We do this in the presence of an acid. And so I'm trying to see, let's do it this way. We take and we add water in the presence of something like H2SO4. So it requires a strong acid. And what we wind up getting is we wind up getting an alcohol. And there are two possible alcohols that we can get. And we find that the major alcohol is this one on the left. And the question is sort of why, what's going on here? Let's look at the mechanism of what this reaction is. When we go through and start this mechanism, it starts with the acid. So we can think about different sources of acid. It could be anytime you have H2SO4 in solution with water, it's always level to hydronium. It's really hydronium that is the active acid that is here. If I look at this as hydronium, I can think about the double bond reaching out and grabbing the proton and taking the proton from the water molecule. Now, why can it do that? Why would a double bond reach out and grab a proton? If you think about what a double bond is, that double bond is the pi electrons above and below the system. And this is my electron density that is sitting here in these pi electrons. Those pi electrons can act as a nucleophile. And what they're doing is they're looking for an electrophile. They're looking for something that has a strong partial positive charge on it. And that is exactly what that proton does. And so you're looking at something here which has electron density, partial minus to partial positive. It grabs that proton. And as it grabs that proton, it can go in two different directions. And we actually already know the answer to this. We've had enough study to be able to figure out what the right direction is going to be. It's either going to grab the proton this direction, forming that carbocation, or it's going to grab the proton in this direction and make that carbocation. Now, I can highlight this a little bit better in that I can say that there are two existing protons that are already there, and that I'm looking at the proton that maybe we'll track in red. And so my existing protons are still here. Sometimes these obscure what's going on. They obscure the idea, so sometimes I leave them off. But this is what's actually happening. This is a primary carbocation. This is a tertiary carbocation. And so when I look at these two options, and I'm considering my two options of which of the carbocations is more stable, this is kind of a no-brainer. We know that tertiary carbocations are more stable than primary carbocations. This is lower in energy. Not only that, if we look at the energy diagram for this, the energy diagram for this in going from the alkene to the carbocation, we start off at fairly high energy with the alkene. The proton, we're picking up the proton and we're going to a carbocation, a high energy transition state. High energy intermediate, and the transition state for its formation. When I go to that carbocation, I can think about the different carbocations that can form. Actually, I need a little bit more room here. I can think about the two possible carbocations that can form. I can form the tertiary carbocation by picking up that proton there. Or I could form the primary carbocation and forming that primary carbocation. Come on. Why does it do that? There it goes. Sometimes I just have to make it do it a different way. Forming the primary carbocation is much higher in energy and has a much higher activation energy. So with this high activation energy, this thing is slow. And then here, this one, this has a lower E sub A and is fast. This again is going back to Hammond postulate, that as I'm looking at the energy for the formation of these guys, that whichever one of these is lower in energy is going to have the lower activation energy because they are closely related in terms of Hammond postulate, that the transition state is most closely related to the side it is closest in energy to. So this is my primary carbocation. This is my tertiary carbocation. Once I form the tertiary carbocation, then the rest of the reaction is fairly simple. Now water just comes in and reacts with that tertiary carbocation to then go ahead and form the rest of the molecule. So what's going to happen here is a water molecule that's going to come in. Bind to that carbocation, that's going to take me down here to a location where I have the water as a protonated oxonium ion. And then finally, some base is going to take that proton away. And we go to the final product. And we go down a step in energy again. To the alcohol. This guy would have followed two other steps. This would have come down much farther in energy. I'm actually leaving it way too high. But maybe that's what I want to do for now, just because I don't want it to overlap with everything else. This one would have formed this oxonium. And then base would have taken the proton, giving the electrons back. And that would have gone to form that alcohol. And so that's our energy diagram and why the reaction goes the direction that it does. Now, there's a rule to help us remember which direction this actual reaction goes and why it goes this way. It's called Markovnikov addition and Markovnikov's rule. Markovnikov was a Russian chemist. And Markovnikov's rule is one that says the rich get richer. That's sort of like the easy way to remember it. What actually Markovnikov's rule says is the side that has the most hydrogens and by side what I mean is the side of the double bond that has the most hydrogens will get the hydrogen. In other words, that's the manifestation of the rich get richer. The side that has the hydrogens, the most hydrogens, is the side of the reaction that is going to get the hydrogen when it comes out of this reaction. So if we take that in context and we go back and we look at the chemical reaction and we say, all right, we're going to analyze this reaction real quick. Let's take a look at what's going on. The side of the double bond that has the most hydrogens is the right-hand side. So what I've got is I've got two hydrogens that are over here already. And when this picks up the proton and the double bond reaches out and grabs that proton and it can go one of two directions, we said that that hydrogen can go here, generating the C plus versus that hydrogen going out on the terminal end, generating the tertiary carbocation, that the rich get richer idea means that the side that has the most hydrogens is the side that gets the hydrogen. This would be correct. And the reason is because it's developing a tertiary carbocation, whereas this one's developing a secondary. Okay. I don't like Markovnikov's rule. I'll say that right out quick. Nothing against Markovnikov. He was brilliant. I think that what I find difficult with Markovnikov is that it's a rule and that many things will break the rule. And yet, if you understand the underpinnings of Markovnikov's rule, much as Markovnikov did because he was brilliant, is that it is the side that has the more stable carbocation that will develop. And that Markovnikov's rule is really based in the stability of carbocations. And that's what I tend to follow when I think about Markovnikov's rule, is I think about the stability of the carbocation and where the carbocation is going and how that dictates and affects things. So when we look at these hydration reactions, it's really about carbocation stability. And so we can do a series of reactions here where we could look at hydration of an alkene. And if we take a different substrate, we can then use Markovnikov's rule or some other concept here. We could take and do a hydration reaction with H2SO4. And looking at how this is going to work, I always consider my options. So rather than trying to apply Markovnikov's rule and try to figure out what side is going to get the proton, I always like to draw both. I always say, consider your options when you go through and look at a mechanism. And so one thing to do is to say, all right, maybe this side gets the proton and my carbocation falls here. That's one possible outcome. The other possible outcome is that the proton is picked up on the other side and the carbocation falls here, and then analyze those. This is a secondary, this is a tertiary. This is going to be the correct way. So we are not going to go the way of the secondary. And then the water molecule is going to come in, attack the carbocation. We'll follow this one through. There will be a deprotonation. Electrons given back to the oxygen, and then the final product. And this would be expected to be major. And is sometimes referred to as their Markovnikov product. The other one would be the minor product. And yes, we could have drawn this and gotten to this a different way. We could have looked at it and we could have said, all right, where did the proton go? If I was tracking that proton, where did that guy actually go? That proton landed on this carbon over here. Actually, I'm going to do it this way to make it look a little bit more consistent and easy to track where the proton came from and where it went. I'll track the proton over here. I'll track the existing proton. So this was the only proton that was on the double bond to begin with. That proton is sitting here. That proton is sitting there. You can see that this is consistent with Markovnikov's rule. The side of the molecule that has more protons is the side that gets the proton, and that becomes the major product. This one is the minor product. But I always want to take it back to this. This is always my favorite place to reside, to work, is by looking at the carbocations and to go with the more stable carbocation. Why am I always going with a more stable C plus? Because that takes it back to Hammond postulate and finding the lower activation energy. And that's the right way to do these problems, because a lot of times there can be things in these problems that may be inconsistent with Markovnikov's rule because of resonance or other factors. So we always want to be looking at the most stable carbocation. Why is the most stable carbocation so important? But let's take a look at this. Here's another idea. If I take a look at a couple of double bonds and look at protonating them, and here what I'm going to do is I'm going to protonate them with a very strong acid. Let's just call it magic acid, because I just want to look at the protonation. there actually is a magic acid. I don't have the structure of it, but magic acid is oftentimes used to investigate stability of carbocations and how carbocations rearrange the longevity of carbocations. So this is a way to make a carbocation which is not just transient, but that we could follow and track and observe through spectroscopy. And what we find is that the carbocation that gets created here is the tertiary, while the carbocation that gets created here is the secondary. And that this reaction is not just a little faster, it's 10,000 times faster in regards to the stability of that carbocation. That's how much more stable that tertiary carbocation is than the secondary. It is 10,000 times faster in its formation than a secondary carbocation, which means that these are even more dramatic when we consider them against a primary carbocation. That's how important that is. Resonance, induction, all those other things play into this as well. So you can't forget anything that you've learned yet. All of those things that we've learned come back into play in terms of these. Let's take a look at this reaction. This is something that we've done and we've talked about already. If I take an alcohol and I react it with H3PO4 and heat, this is a reaction that we have seen. This is an E1 reaction. In an E1 reaction, what I do is I form an alkene. And the byproduct that comes out of this is water. This reaction is the absolute reverse reaction of hydration. So hydration reactions are actually reversible. When I take a look at what's happening here, the water molecule gets protonated, or the hydroxyl group gets protonated. Once the hydroxyl group is protonated, I've created a good leaving group. The high energy that's in the reaction, the heat here, causes this bond to break, goes through the carbocation, and then something pulls a proton, more than likely the water molecule that just left, which then makes the alkene. It's the exact reverse reaction. So what we see is that these reactions that we're doing, that if I take and think about this as a hydroxyl group, actually let's do it the other way. Let's think about it as the alkene, that I can go in the forwards direction by taking and reacting this with water and some acid, H2SO4 or phosphoric acid, and I can create the alcohol. That's hydration. Or I could come back and I could take and I can react this with H2SO4, no water, and heat, and this is an elimination reaction. E1. That these reactions, hydration and elimination, are reverse reactions, and that I can make alkenes through elimination, or I can make alcohols through hydration. So this is an absolutely reversible reaction in terms of my ability to be able to either go towards the alcohol or from the alcohol to the alkene. So, and that mechanism is very similar. When I think about the mechanism and I look at what I've just shown here, protonation of the alcohol, loss of leaving group, removal of proton to form the alkene. In the other reactions, what I was doing was addition of proton, formation of carbocation, addition of water, deprotonation to form alcohol. Each one of these steps is a reversible step. And which direction the reaction goes depends on whether I am adding water, or as I'm doing down here, I can see adding water. So water is part of my reaction. Or in the bottom reaction, I'm eliminating water, I'm removing water. And one of the key things here is that heat. So hydration depends on water, elimination depends on heat and the loss of water. So there's a couple of things. Many of these reactions that are in the alkene chapter are very, very similar. They all work from similar types of reactions. Let me show you another one that is not hydration, but let's look at addition of acids. When I look at addition of acid, take just this guy first off, and we look at adding HCl. What I do here is I take the proton from the hydrochloric acid, give back the electrons to the chlorine. We go through, and as always, when we protonate, we have to consider where the proton went. The proton can either go on the left-hand side, or the proton can go on the right-hand side. And again, we already know the answer to this, primary versus tertiary. This one is faster, lower energy. It does not go the route of the primary. The chloride then comes in, just like the water molecule would have, and attacks. We don't need a deprotonation at this point. And that becomes our major product. The other one would be minor. Okay, so many of these reactions are going to look identical because they are all the same type of reaction. They are called electrophilic addition. So these are all under electrophilic addition reactions. There's no Y in there. Electrophilic addition to alkene. These electrophilic addition reactions, all of them run essentially the same thing. There's going to be some little tweaks within each one of the electrophilic addition reactions that I do, but primarily they're all going to be the same. Primarily, they're all going to look like this. We have a double bond that is reacting with something that is an electrophile. Let's stop it there. This is either going to have a partial positive or a full positive. I am going to grab the electrophile, and when it grabs the electrophile, then what forms is a carbocation, and then some other nucleophile will come in, bond to the carbocation, and I will get the electrophile attached to one side and the nucleophile attached to the other. Now, what side goes where depends on which side is more substituted. And so I can think about it in regards to this way, that whatever it is, that incoming electrophile, that electrophile is predominantly going to give the more stable carbocation, and the nucleophile will come in and attack the more stable carbocation. So we've seen that in the hydrations. We just looked at that where I have water reacting with H2SO4. and that I get the water coming in and the proton was my electrophile. The water was my nucleophile. So I can couch that this way. So it's all tracking just right. I just did the same thing with HCl. So as HCl comes in, what I find is that the chlorine ends up on the more substituted, the proton on the less substituted. The proton was my electrophile, the chlorine then was my nucleophile. And the reaction is running absolutely consistent in terms of these electrophilic additions. So what most people do is most people tend to look at these reactions and see them as all being different. And every time the reaction is different and every time you put in a new substrate, the reaction looks even more different. And in reality, the reaction isn't any different. If you can see it in this format, if you can see it in terms of electrophile and nucleophile and how the reaction is going forward, it becomes much easier to understand. Let's take a look at another idea here though. Something that I want to remind you about so that you don't forget. Let's take and do the same reaction that we've been doing. Let's do an electrophilic addition. Let's do HCl. This is 25 degrees C. Maybe running in something like THF, an ether solvent. And we want to look at the products. What we would expect is in looking at the products is that this is going to reach out. It's going to grab the proton. As it does so, it's going to go through the more stable carbocation. So that proton is going to be grabbed out of the primary. I'll get the secondary carbocation. The chloride will come in, we'll grab that spot, and then we'll make the product. And so we would expect that the major product that we would get would be this one, right? I mean, that's what we were expecting as the major product. We just went through the entire mechanism. And the answer is that that maybe not so much. That what we expect to see really is where the chlorine falls on that position and that this one becomes major. The question is, wait, what? What just happened? Well, this was a secondary carbocation. And that secondary carbocation, if I think about that secondary carbocation, I have a proton here that can shift to that carbocation and I can do a 1,2 hydride shift. The 1,2 hydride shift then takes me to a tertiary carbocation. And we know that that happens to be more stable and that this is an extremely fast thing that winds up happening that leads to the major product. So we cannot forget about the carbocation formation and that anytime we go through a carbocation, we need to watch for shifts. Watch for 1,2 hydride and 1,2 alkyl shifts. Anytime there is carbocation formation. So we saw this in the SN1 and E1, right? So this is SN1, this is E1 in terms of carbocation formation. This is also electrophilic addition. So anytime there's carbocation formation, we need to be thinking about those hydride, 1,2 hydride and 1,2 alkyl shifts in order to give the major products. Critically important. Apple Pencil. Okay. In regards to that, we can also look at, so we're talking the same same reaction here. Let's also do HCl. Let's think about what's going to happen in this reaction. We're going to grab the proton. We're going to go through the carbocation. We should get the secondary carbocation. Proton landed out here on the primary position. This is secondary. We consider, is there any hydride shifts that can happen? No, these are all methyl groups. But what I can have is I can have the alkyl shift. And so as I go through an alkyl shift, this is a 1-2 alkyl shift that takes me to a tertiary carbocation, and then the chloride can come in and attack. And that takes me to a product that is the major product. The other product would have come from this guy where the chloride came in on the secondary. And that one's going to take me to the minor product. So those are the two products that would have formed, the alkyl shift being the more favorable product. Just to give you an idea, this is about 60% in terms of the reaction product. And this one's about 37%. You say, wait a minute, 60 and 37 don't add up to 100. That's true, because there's some other stuff that happens too that we're not looking at. But that's about my 60% and 37%, roughly 60-40 in favor of the 1-2 alkyl shift product and the more stable carbocation. All right, time check. We've got about 10 minutes. I think what I want to go through and do, let's ask a question here. Let's say that what I want is I want to make this 37% and I want to make that major. So Mother Nature is telling me that I'm always going to have these shifts taking place in order to, when this reaction goes, because the reaction is always going to go in favor of the lowest possible energy. So is there some way that I can get 37% into the major product? In other words, if every time I do this reaction, what happens if I want this other product? So let's say that I have this double bond and I really want this material. How can we make this? That's the real question. And the reason is because as an organic chemist, when Mother Nature tells me that I can't have something, when Mother Nature gives me this, and this is how this reaction always goes, the question then starts to become, well, what if I really want to make this? I need a tool to be able to make this. If Mother Nature naturally gives me this one, what sort of tool can I develop in order to do this? Well, that means that I need to prevent the shift in some way. So how can I prevent the shift? The only way that I can think about preventing the shift is if I can stabilize the carbocation in some way. Here's a way that we do it. This is called oxymercuration demercuration. What I do is I take the reaction that I want to have and I do the reaction number one with something called mercury acetate, HgOAC, There's two of these groups. And then I include a nucleophile with this. So some nucleophile is added into this. And then the second step is a step to get rid of the mercury. This is where I use a reagent, sodium borohydride. Now, fortunately, in lab, we have looked at sodium borohydride, so I don't need to talk about sodium borohydride as much, but let's see what actually happens here. Mercury acetate is a mercury 2+, and it is bound to acetate ions, which each have a negative charge, and stabilize the mercury. So this is HgOAC2. That's what that anion is. What winds up happening here is that the mercury lets go of one of these acetates. In letting go of the mercury, of the, one of the acetates, the mercury now is Hg with only one of these. And this complex, instead of being neutral, now has a positive charge. The double bond sees that mercury as a strong electrophile, and it binds to the mercury. But when it binds to the mercury, mercury also has lone pairs of electrons that are on that metal. Those lone pairs of electrons are donated back, and it makes what's called a cyclic mercurium ion, Hg, and it is binding to this side and this side, and it has the O acetate group that is on it. And this is the ion that is being formed. The mercury is bearing a partial positive charge, and there is a partial positive charge which is born on the more stable side of where the carbocation would have formed. What the mercury is doing by binding to both sides is the mercury is sort of sticking its finger in the hole in the dam, preventing the shift because there is not a full carbocation. Now there is no alkyl shift or hydride shift. The mercury sort of has its finger on the button and holds the place so that the shift can't actually happen. But what does happen is the nucleophile now can come in, usually as an anion, and open the mercury up, binding to the location of the more stable partial positive. So now what I have is I have my nucleophile that is attached to this. I have the mercury, which is hanging out over here with the acetate. And then what I do is I use the sodium borohydride in the second step, where the sodium borohydride delivers a hydride reagent. It delivers an H minus. And this H minus then reduces off the mercury, kicking the mercury out, replacing it with a hydrogen. And in this way, I get the nucleophile and the hydrogen, and it does so with no shift. That's the key thing with oxymercuration, demercuration. So now what I'm able to do is I'm able to go through and to run the same reaction that I ran before. I can take the same substrate, where before I was getting this product, this rearranged product as my major product. Now what I can do is I can go through and I can run the reaction this way. So let's compare. If I take and run this reaction with just HCl, the major product is the one where we get the chlorine on that position. But if I take and run this with number one, and we need the one and two, so I'll explain what that means. HgOAC2, and we'll put a comma here, and instead of HCl, we run it with sodium chloride. That gives us the chloride anion. And then two, we come in and we run it with sodium borohydride. The one and two are steps. It means two different reactions. It means that these reactions are done at different times. They are not put into the round bottom at the same time. These two reactions or reagents are incompatible and can't go in the flask at the same time. What happens is we do the mercury acetate, then we throw in the sodium chloride along with it. And then when that reaction is done, then we throw in the sodium borohydride and we do this in two steps. And what we see is that we get the chlorine going onto the secondary position with no shift from the same substrate. That is pretty cool. And yet there may be one more question that we could ask, right? So if when we're running this reaction, we do the reaction without any fancy stuff and we get the chlorine going here, and if we use this mercury acetate reaction and we get the chlorine going on the secondary position, what about this? When I think about doing HCl, I said that my products were 37% and 60%, and there was a missing 3%. What was that missing 3%? Well, that missing 3% was really where the chlorine goes on that position versus that position versus the shifted position. And so this one was 60%. This was 37%. That missing 3% was sort of here. We now know how to make this one major. We just run the reaction straight. We know how to make this reagent. We do it with mercury acetate, the oxymercuration, demercuration. That's how we get that one. How do we make this one major? What if I want that substituent in the primary position? Is there a way that we can make this one major? And it turns out there is. And this is what organic chemists do, that we take a look at all of the products that come out of chemical reactions. And regardless of what Mother Nature tells us, we try to find ways to control the reaction to be able to make the different products major. And we look at different reactivities and different ways of controlling them. And indeed, there is a way to be able to get this product to be the major product, but it takes a lot more explaining. And we'll have to look at that next week. We'll take a look at that on Tuesday on how we can actually get to that product through yet a different reaction. So lots of cool stuff with these electrophilic additions. And we'll find that there's just all kinds of different reactions that we can do that are all electrophilic addition reactions that are very, very mechanistically similar and yet give wildly different products. We're gonna have to find a way of organizing these. We'll talk about star charts. We'll talk about this reaction when we come back and how we get this. Lots more to come yet. And this is where we start getting really exciting because we start to get lots and lots of different reactions that we can do, which on one hand sounds sort of anxiety producing, on another hand, sounds sort of exciting because of the great diversity of things that we can start to create when we think about the different sorts of reactions that we can do. So lots more to come. All right, I'm going to go do some grading and some Canvas shell updating. I'll get this up and posted, and maybe I'll see a few of you in office hours coming up here in another half an hour. All right, have a good weekend. Take care. Bye-bye.